Hello, and welcome to another episode of my podcast, Stepping Up. My name is Sue Reed, and every week I provide a platform for people to tell their story of how they have faced and overcome a challenge in their life. Here is today's story. Hi, so my guest today is a really lovely lady who's here to tell her story. And it's the very first time she's spoken publicly about this. For the purpose of the podcast, she wishes only to be known as H, and it will become clear as to why H does not want to reveal her full name. So welcome to the show, H. It's lovely to have you here.
Great to be here. I'm not going to lie, I'm a little bit scared, but I feel that there's a lot of people out there who are in a similar situation, could be in a similar situation. And if there's anything that I can do or say that might help them have more awareness and more courage, then I know that I'm doing this for the right reason.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I'm sure it'd be very, very valuable. You want to talk about a relationship that didn't turn out the way you were hoping it would turn out. Where would you like to start?
There's so many things we could talk about. So I was in a relationship with someone who turned out to be a narcissist, who was an alcoholic and had other addictions. And part of the narcissism was compulsive lying. And the compulsive lying also led to serial cheating. And it was one of those situations that I genuinely thought I was old enough and wise enough and a good judge of character to have not ended up in a situation like this. Like I very much dislike people who are dishonest, and I've called out people when they have been dishonest. And to have been completely, I don't know, hoodwinked.
What was
just astounding to me.
What was it you fell for then? What hooked you in?
I think sort of my lessons learned after kind of a lot of therapy and coaching and really unpicking what happened, so that I can protect myself from it not happening again, was our very first date. We spent the weekend together, and the alcohol kind of was an issue. And so after that first weekend, when we had a phone conversation, I was like, yeah, I don't really think I want to see you again, because it's, you know, my father was an alcoholic. He was also violent, and I kind of just didn't want to be in that situation. You know, I didn't want to be around someone who's drinking maybe out of control. And so I gave the reason that, you know, I wasn't comfortable about seeing them again, because I was concerned with the level of drinking, and that's not really my thing in terms of a relationship. And myself being like teetotal was just kind of, it was, you know, just not my thing. And that was a red flag that I ignored. And I don't know how I ignored it. I don't know how I was talked out of ignoring it. But, you know, after several conversations, we arranged another date.
And how long was that before, from the first date when you thought something's not right here, to the next date? How long did it take them to talk you around?
I think it was about 10 days. And the conversations, and again, I hadn't ever been in a situation like this. I had been in a 12-year relationship, so I wasn't really that familiar with dating. You know, I'd been single for about a year after a 12-year relationship. So I wasn't, you know, I didn't know all the things to look out for that I do now. And the phone conversations in that 10-day period were quite long. And I falsely believed that the other person was interested in me, that they were asking me questions, they were getting to know me. So I took the time that they spent on the phone with me as like almost overriding the red flag about the alcohol.
Yeah, thinking maybe I was wrong, maybe they're not what I thought they were. And presumably because you'd been in a long relationship, come out of a relationship, not quite knowing what to do next as far as dating was concerned, that made you slightly vulnerable. And that type of person, that's what they tend to hone in on, isn't it? They kind of, they've got it like a radar that looks out for women who and sometimes men who are potentially vulnerable and easily won over. Do you think that might have been the case?
Yes. In hindsight, I can say yes. But at the time, that year, I didn't feel vulnerable. I actually felt quite invincible because, you know, I had been, you know, single probably for just over a year. I had met a new group of friends. I was going out more than ever before. I was doing all the things that I loved. And I felt like full of life, full of beans, like a smile on my face. I was just genuinely having a great year. And so I didn't feel vulnerable. I just felt, yeah, I felt invincible. And so, yeah, it's bizarre. It's bizarre.
Things are always strange when you look back on them. So now you're getting attention from this person who is, you know, phoning you, talking to you a long time on the phone. So obviously showing lots and lots of interest, making you feel good. What happened next then?
We ended up just spending a lot more time together. And so sort of almost every weekend, and then it was Christmas and New Year's, and I went over on Boxing Day, and it's just we spent a lot of time together. And then suddenly out of nowhere, I was ghosted. And I didn't quite understand, because it gone from, you know, lots of long phone conversations to lots of time in each other's company at each other's houses. And then suddenly he disappeared. And again, that was another red flag, because all my friends at the time were like, oh, you know, you've dodged a bullet there. Like, you know, count your blessings. And then it was actually me who, after 2 weeks, I think it was about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks of being ghosted, I heard a song on the radio when I was driving to work one day, and it completely reminded me of him and our situation. And just without really thinking too much, I just sent a message. And then immediately I got a message back. Yeah. And then I asked the question, what happened? And they said, you know, they had like a bit of a situation. They had like a situation with an ex, and just things, you know, they weren't kind of right in their, they just weren't in a good place. I think that was it. They weren't in a good place. And so again, it was almost like I fell into the trap of feeling sorry for them.
Yeah.
That, you know, they weren't in a good place, and suddenly they got my sympathy back, as opposed to me being angry of like, where have you been? Like, you know, why haven't you contacted me?
It's almost like I was saying about how were you hooked. It's almost like it is, if we use a fishing analogy, it's kind of like that bait was in the water waiting for you to take a bite. So as soon as you sent the message, yeah, back on the scene again, I've got you now, sort of thing.
Yeah. And it's much to my friend's dismay, because they were like, why did you do that? And it was just, And what I came to realize after, like I said, therapy, there was a book that really kind of opened my eyes to it all, is that as much as he had his addictions, I became addicted to the game.
Yeah.
It's kind of like this cat and mouse game. And I hadn't even realized it was a game, but I'd become, hooked in my own way.
Yeah. Yeah. You're kind of on a line now, and it's very difficult to get back off again. Okay. So, and it sounds like your friends could see a bit clearer than you could. It sounds like they were warning you that maybe this wasn't the place you wanted to be. Do you think that was the case?
Yeah, I think they could see that him with his addictions and me being teetotal and sober wasn't kind of like a recipe for success. Mm. But in my head, I don't really have any judgments about whether people drink or smoke or whatever. You know, what they do is what they do, as long as it doesn't harm me. Mm. So I didn't see it as an issue, but obviously from their point of view, they could. And one of my best friends, this is quite telling, she said to me probably about 20 years ago that I shouldn't be allowed to choose my own boyfriends because I seem to choose the wrong people for me. And so when I was in this 12-year relationship, I was like, well, you know, maybe I've exonerated myself, you know, because, you know, 12 years is a fairly good innings. You know, there's a lot of people out there that who have marriages that last less than 12 years. So I, you know, I kind of was thinking, well, you know, I must be doing something right. You know, I can't be all, you know, that bad. But yeah, clearly I hadn't learned my lessons.
I wouldn't blame yourself, because I think it is very, very easy for those types of people. They know how to play the game. They've played it before. You are a new player. So you're now playing the game with them, but they are much more experienced than you. So they know exactly how to play you and how to hook you in. And people, again, going back to the fishing analogy, the fish around know that you've taken that bite, and they know that, you know, they're sitting there thinking, yeah, you're doing this wrong. You shouldn't have gone there. Too late now. I can't stop you. It's kind of, you just get dragged along. Do you think at any time you thought you might change him to kind of fix him, or?
It's really interesting that you say that, because that's exactly what my friend said, that you are not there to fix him. You're not there to help him. Another friend even said, you know, if you build him for all the the hours of like counseling and coaching that you gave him, you could probably retire. And I didn't, as much as I saw his flaws, I didn't see that my role, I didn't see my role as being a fixer. And I think that was part of the game, that you kind of do get, you know, dragged into the fixing without actually consciously being aware of it.
Yeah.
You know, you just think you're being a good friend, a good partner. You think you're being, you know, caring and considerate, but actually you're being manipulated and used.
Mm. So what happened next then? When did things start to go from bad to worse, sort of thing?
Yeah, things really took a nosedive when I remember this quite clearly. I had suspicions that he'd been cheating on me, and I couldn't prove it. There was no evidence. He would always talk me around. He'd always have some kind of plausible argument, and he was insisting on meeting my family, which, given my suspicions about his lack of loyalty, I did not feel comfortable about. And I really didn't want him to meet my family. And it was August bank holiday weekend, and he insisted. He was like, you know, the reason I want to meet your family is, you know, that I see something long term with you. So, you know, this is when we are all together. like, you know, and your closest friends are available. And so, yeah, it was an August bank holiday. And he somehow convinced me that, you know, that despite my suspicions, that he should meet my family. And it was the 31st of August. So not long after the August bank holiday weekend, I get a phone call from a friend who is clearly upset. And I know that she's just been on holiday. So I'm a bit confused as to why she's upset. And she's like, I've got something to tell you. And in my head, I'm thinking, oh, you know, something bad has happened to her and, you know, she needs to get it off her chest. And she was like, no, it's about you. And I was like, well, what do you mean? She goes, well, I've been on holiday with some friends and one of their friends has been with your boyfriend.
Right.
And she was like, I don't want to be the one to tell you this, but I have to tell you this because I know it and it's a fact. So I know that he's cheating on you because I know of the person that he's been messing around with. And even though I'd had my suspicions, that conversation rocked me hard.
Yeah, because it's the truth, yeah.
One, it's the truth, and it's the fact that it didn't come from him or it didn't come from me finding out. It's the fact that one of my closest friends had to hear it and be put in a position where she either chooses to ignore it or to say something to me. But either way, she's caught up in something that she kind of didn't ever need to be caught up in.
No, that's right.
And it's put her in a tricky situation. And it's so I'm feeling bad for her kind of having to tell me.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and so what happened then? Did you confront him?
Yeah, because I was due to see him, and I was like, I'm not coming. Like, I'm not coming. And he's like, why? And I'm like, well, this is what I've been told. And, you know, I was like, this is categoric. And he still, in the beginning, tried to deny it. And then I don't know whether it was the same day or the next day, he kind of owned up to it. And then a few days later, it was like, you know, something bad has happened to me sort of in a work situation. I'm, you know, really not in a good way. Like, I really can't handle this at this time. And again, it was like he made me feel sorry for him.
Mm.
So he was the one who cheated. And I had been the one that had found out not from him. And yet somehow he twisted it and made me feel sorry for him.
Mm. So, and then you went back to him?
Not immediately, because I was like, this is just too painful. And I think it took him about, I'm trying to think, it would have been about a month to really like work my head.
What was that, with constant phone calls again? Or
yeah it was the phone calls and the messages. Mm-hmm. And I guess it was the promise or the hope that things would be different. I'm sure if he ever used the words, you know, it won't happen again, or whether I kind of made it known that I was done, like, you know, after all that time of having the suspicions and then having those suspicions confirmed, it was like really like, yeah, you know, that, like, if there is any like comeback, you literally are on your last strike. Like, this is, you know, there's no more. Like, I literally can't take any more. And then we had a weekend in Paris. Yeah, a great weekend. And I remember sitting in Charles de Gaulle Airport and my stomach actually wasn't turning. because normally when I used to see him, I would get like butterflies of excitement. And what I noticed about being in that airport is that I was kind of numb, like resigned. Like I was there. I wasn't 100% sure if I should be there.
Yeah, it sounds kind of like you now realize that you're in a trap. You now realize that you do need to get out of this. The realization setting in. Had at that time he'd met your family. So he had been to meet your family. And what did they think of him?
They thought he was very, in some of his views, they thought he was very old-fashioned. You know, his views about like how a woman should be and how a man should be in a relationship. They thought the thing is, he's very charismatic. So it was, yeah, he knows how to hold a crowd. He knows how to engage people. He, you know, he can be all like smiles when he wants to be. So I think they knew that I wasn't 100% sure. Everyone, it was almost like, it was almost like we all played a game. Like we all put our smiley faces on and we had a really great time. But there was, it was almost that kind of, you know, that side eye thing of like, you know, that's your choice, but we're going to still kind of look out for you, you know.
Yeah, so they kind of picked up on it.
There was no seal of approval. Let's put it that way.
Right. No.
Yeah.
Okay, so Charles de Gaulle Airport, you're sitting there and feeling, should I be here or shouldn't I? And knowing really that you shouldn't be there. So what happened next?
Yeah. And so then we sort of, you know, we got our transport to the hotel and we're at the hotel and I'm still kind of like, feeling quite tense, feeling quite anxious. And I wouldn't class myself as anyone who's ever kind of had to deal with anxiety. Like I, you know, it's not something that I related to prior to the relationship with him. But as time wore on, I was more and more anxious because I kind of didn't know. I didn't know who to believe. I didn't know who to trust. I didn't know what was real. I didn't know what wasn't real. And, you know, we went out for a meal. The meal was fine. And then we went out dancing, which is something that we both love. We just had like a fantastic night, you know, like it was just a great night. And it was kind of like you said, I was hooked back in.
Yeah. Yeah. Hook, line and sinker by the sound of it. So, and then when did you start to realize it's, you know, gone wrong again? When did it start to fall back down?
It's just, my sister started mentioning the term gaslighting and I didn't know what gaslighting was. And so I looked it up about, you know, how someone kind of says things to you so that you stop trusting yourself. So that you stop trusting your intuition, you don't listen to your gut, they kind of isolate you from your family and friends and sort of, there was a time sort of immediately after the relationship that I binge watched things on like narcissism and gaslighting. And I probably reeled off a dictionary definition back then, but I'm over that phase now, thankfully. And yeah, so my sister mentioned that term and I started looking at videos about narcissism and I kind of started thinking, is this what I'm in? Like, is this it, you know? And so then I started trying to look for clues as to, you know, am I making this up in my head? Or am I in a relationship with a narcissist?
Again, that's a really, really clever part of the game where you end up almost blaming yourself, thinking, well, it's not them, it's me. I'm reading it wrong. I'm being, you know, too emotional, blah, blah, blah. And you start doubting yourself. That's quite common. And you start ignoring then the instincts and eventually they start to die down and you almost then resign yourself to where you've ended up, and then it does become your fault because you chose to stay there. It does get very, very difficult. What happened next? How did it come to a head? How did it end?
Yeah, it ended, and this was after he insisted that I meet his family. So that, again, I think this is all part of the ploy, is that I will, you know, introduce you to all my friends, all my family, to my business associates, so that you get that false sense of security that you're actually in a real relationship that is meaningful and could possibly have a future. And they kind of entrench you in their life to the point that I was kind of, helping them on so many fronts. And I was really involved in their life. And then there was the line of, you know, well, I wouldn't be involving you this much in my life if I didn't care for you, if I didn't want you in my life. So again, even that is part of the kind of entrapment, the web, really, the web of life. And eventually it came to a head where we were having a phone conversation, and he was in a hotel room in New York. And I just had this feeling that there was someone there. And, you know, I said, "Who's there?" And he said, "No one." And then partway through the conversation, he was like, "Oh, just give me a second." And I heard him speak to someone, and he didn't even mute himself. And then he came back on the call with me, and I'm like, "You're clearly talking to someone. Like, who is there?" He's like, "There's no one here." You know, it was just like, there was no one there. And again, he did that. I was like, and I think sort of either one of us, due to the time difference, one of us was about to fall asleep. So it's like we didn't continue the conversation, but I left that conversation feeling like sick to the, you know, pit of my stomach. And then the next time we spoke, I was like, "That's it, I'm done." And they're like, "What do you mean you're done?" I was like, "No, I'm done. Like I'd kind of left him already three times and he'd reeled me back in. And I was like, "No, it's, you know, it's completely over." And they kept me on the phone for 2 hours. I had nothing to say. I kept saying, "I have nothing to say. We've got nothing to talk about. There is no comeback from this. You know, you cannot talk me around. Like, we've, you know, there's nothing that we haven't said to each other that we haven't said before. Like, we've been down this road before, you know, with the suspicions, with, you know, the lies, with the, you know, the all the stuff about the addictions. We, you know, we've covered all this ground. There's nothing that we can say." And I just don't even know to this day how they kept me on the phone for 2 hours when I had nothing to say. And then even like days afterwards, it was like, he said, "Oh, I've spoken to my family. They've suggested we get, you know, couples counseling. You know, we were going to move in together. We were going to, you know, we booked a holiday for his birthday." You know, it was like, you know, there were so many ways that he was trying to sort of get back in. And I was like, you know, we came into each other's lives for a reason. And I believe that we've both learned the lessons that we need to learn, and that chapter is closed. And
time to move on.
And there was, I think I read a postcard somewhere, and it was like, you know, no situation is worth, if situation steals your peace, then it's not worth it. And I had gotten to the point where I felt I had no peace left in my mind. I'd gone from not ever being anxious to permanently feeling like I was walking on eggshells, to overthinking everything, to overanalyzing everything, to reading between the lines, to, you know, like analyzing messages, analyzing words. Like I think I kind of just turned into some like crazy detective. Like I felt like I was going crazy. And then even then they sort of like in one of the messages to me were like, you know, they said to me, you need therapy. And I was like, no, it's not me, it's you. Like, it's you. You're the one who's making me feel anxious. Your lies are what is making me feel unsettled. And they even said, you know, you need to own up to your part in this.
Yeah.
Like, what is my part? And that hurt. But eventually I've made peace with that, because yeah, I did play a part. I played a part each time I went back, each time I ignored a red flag, each time I let myself be talked around, I played my part.
And but it was never your fault. Yes, you played your part, and yes, you went back, but you were part of a trap, like we said. It's all part of a game. You were the fish that he put the bait out, and you took it. So
yeah, and I didn't realize I was addicted, and now I was so addicted. I was so addicted to the game, and then I had to like realize that actually, that maybe, and this is what I learned from a book, that maybe I'm a codependent, maybe I'm a people pleaser, maybe from each time that he talked me around by saying something had gone wrong in his life or his business and made me feel sorry for him, made me disregard my own needs. And did I even know what my needs were? And what were my non-negotiables? What were my boundaries? And that's the work that I've had to do on myself in, you know, the time that has passed, is figuring out who I am. What are my needs? What are my goals? What are my essential requirements? Where are my boundaries? Because one of the ways that I kind of got reeled in was I was at a crossroads in my life, in that I'd been in an industry for a very long time, kind of knew I wanted to get out of that industry, but didn't have a way forward. So my goals were really unclear. So it was so easy for me to help him pursue his goals. And he welcomed that because it made his life easier. And I had to take a step back and have a word with myself and say, who am I and what are my goals? Because when I can be committed to my own goals, then I won't be thrown off course again.
No, when you understand yourself and lay your own boundaries down and don't let anybody cross them. So how long did it take for him actually to leave your life completely and you know, stop making any contact?
I think it was a good few months after we split up, and I was like, you know, I'd binge watched all my stuff on like narcissism, and then, you know, I had a really good fitness regime. I was, you know, hanging out with friends, and then it was the day before New Year's Eve that I just get a long email out of nowhere, because I'd blocked them on, you know, various social media, and suddenly this email just pops out of nowhere. And it was a very lengthy email acknowledging their part, not actually using the word sorry, I don't think, or maybe just using it once, very much about them, saying that they'd, you know, they'd gotten tons of therapy, and you know, they felt that they had to reach out to me, and they felt that they had to say what they needed to say. And I didn't reply, and then a few months later there's another email, and again I didn't reply. So yeah,
and then eventually it stopped, did it? And how long ago has it been since the last email?
Nearly a year.
Okay. So the probability now is that you won't hear from him again. Is it always in the back of your mind that you might just make contact again?
I think for me, the thing that I know to be true is that we will run into each other again, because we're in not the same social circle, but we do have kind of friends that overlap. And yeah, and but I feel really good, but then I also know with when you come out of relationships with a narcissist, when you feel really good is another time that they can reel you in, because you mm-hmm. think that you can't get reeled back in because you feel really good, and then they kind of catch you off guard.
Yeah. Yeah, so you need some sort of armor. But when he reappears in some shape or form. So if you were to run into him now, what do you think the outcome would be? Do you feel that you're strong enough to just say, no, not even going to talk to you?
It's really, and I think because narcissists kind of prey on people who are generally kind of quite kind, compassionate, giving, yeah. caring,
yeah,
you know, empaths, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I kind of don't like having situations where there's like crosswords and bad words, you know, I don't like leaving things that way. And the way that I feel at the moment is that I understand that we both went through what we went through for a reason. And the therapy and the coaching I've had has made me a much stronger person. And I didn't have it specifically to get over him as such, because I was kind of over him anyway. But it was just more for me to set my own goals and boundaries.
Yeah.
And set me on a new career path as well. So I have a lot, strangely, I have a lot to be grateful for, even to him, because if I hadn't have done the work, I wouldn't be where I am now.
No.
And so actually I have a much better life now because I had that therapy and coaching, and I may never have had that therapy and coaching if I hadn't have been in that situation.
Mm.
So I feel at the moment that I'm grateful that we went through what we went through, because I learned a hell of a lot. That, you know, my 12 years of being in a really nice, stable, solid, comfortable, secure relationship didn't teach me or prepare me for. And this kind of whirlwind of like intense drama, I've now found I've regained my inner peace. Mm-hmm. I've regained my sense of self. I'm probably even more confident than I was before. And so I've let him go with love. Like, I feel like I've let him go with love. So if I were to just run into him in the street today, I'd like to think that we could have a civil conversation with no raised words, no crosswords. And I'd like to think that I'd have enough respect for my own boundaries for them not to be crossed.
Mm. Brilliant. And so if somebody's listening to this, anyone's listening who recognizes that kind of situation and feels I'm there or I've been in that situation, what advice would you want to give them apart from get out?
Literally, yeah, the safest thing is, you know, I watched a lot of Dr. Ramani videos, is that you have to get out for your sanity, for your physical safety. And it's not easy, because there will be months of going through everything in your mind of, you know, if I had done this, or if I had said this, or, you know, because like you said towards the beginning, you do blame yourself. You blame yourself, all the situations, all the dramas, all the just, you know. And then so it's not easy. It's not easy to get out. It usually takes more than one attempt. And once you're out, it is all about blocking all forms of contact.
Yeah. Don't leave any doors open that they can climb back in through. Yeah.
And it's not going to be an easy road ahead. But once you do the work on yourself, then what emerges is something even more powerful than who you were before you went into that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think going through the dark, you come out at the other side, you come out back out into the light, and you've taken the learning from that dark period And as long as you take that out to the other side with you, it makes you a stronger person. Brilliant. Mm. It's been absolutely amazing listening to your story, and you're brave to come on, and you're brave to have gone through it and to have come out the other end a stronger person. So thank you so much for coming on today and telling your story. I do wish you all the best for the future, and I know the future will be bright for you, and I'm sure you'll find somebody else who will be your soulmate, the person that you deserve, clearly.
It's been such a wonderful conversation, and yeah, I'm glad that we did this. Really glad.
Brilliant. Okay. Lovely. Well, you take care of yourself, and I'll say goodbye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to today's story. And as always, if you want to ensure you don't miss any future episodes, then please subscribe. And if you yourself have a story to tell, then please do get in touch with me. I'd love to hear from you. And until next week, take care of yourself, stay safe, and I will see you soon. Goodbye.